Hello and welcome to our CrossCast webinar series. My name is Katie Turner. I'm the Education and Programming Coordinator here at Cross Financial. Today's topic is Back to the Basics, Planning with Medicaid Compliant Annuity, hosted by Erin Kempman, a Senior Relationship Specialist here at Cross Financial. First, we have a few housekeeping items. If you have any questions during today's webinar, go ahead and type those in the questions section of the GoToWebinar toolbar so we can answer them at the end of the presentation. Next, a copy of today's PowerPoint can be found in the handout section of the GoToWebinar toolbar. We also ask that you please complete the post-webinar survey that will pop up on your screens at the end of the presentation. And now, let's get to today's presentation. Erin, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Katie. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another CrossCast webinar, Back to Basics, Planning with a Medicaid Compliant Annuity. So just a little bit about myself. As Katie mentioned, I'm Erin Kempman. I'm a Senior Relationship Manager. I've been with Cross Financial for just about 15 years now. When I first started, I was what we refer to in-house as a benefits planner, meaning I was the one who would work with the attorney and their staff putting together the financial plans on behalf of your client in order to protect as much of your client's assets as possible while accelerating their Medicaid eligibility. Now my role focuses primarily on working with attorneys who are new to Medicaid planning, new to using Medicaid annuities, working with Cross Financial, really getting them up to speed on the various strategies that we use. Again, in order to protect your client's assets while accelerating their Medicaid eligibility. We also travel across the country to various CLE events. So if you ever see a Cross Financial booth, more than likely I'm going to be there. Stop by and say hi. I'd love to meet all of you in person. A little bit about Cross Financial. We're an attorney-led firm that provides asset preservation solutions nationwide for estate planning and elder law attorneys. Our primary focus is Medicaid crisis planning and the Medicaid compliant annuity. However, we do have some other specialized insurance products, such as durable zero expense trusts, small whole life insurance policies, and also for your proactive planning clients, we also offer long-term care insurance. So we have both the traditional and the asset-based products. So across financial, we really want to be kind of your back office when it comes to long-term care planning. So if you have a client in a long-term care situation, give us a call. We'll be happy to discuss those case facts. And if one of our products or solutions makes sense, great. You know, then we can then look at that doing some planning. So now let's get into today's webinar. Today's goals, let's start off with that. First, we'll just discuss kind of the basic requirements of the Medicaid program. So I'll just give you a brief overview of the Medicaid program. Then we will discuss what a Medicaid annuity is and how it's utilized to accelerate eligibility and preserve assets for your clients. And then finally, we'll put everything together and we'll go over two case studies. The first case study will be for the most common married couple situation. And then the second case study will be the most common single person case study as well. So the case study is really put with the rubber to the road. It really helps me when I was learning this stuff. Put everything together and really understand what was going on. So hope you enjoy it. So starting with the Medicaid program. So what is Medicaid? Medicaid is a joint federal and state program. So the federal government establishes the rules, and then each state is going to interpret those laws differently. So I like to think of it as a sandbox. And the federal government established the sandbox, and the states play in that sandbox, and they create their own sandcastle as they see fit, so long as it stays within that sandbox. However, if the states decide that they want to play outside of that sandbox, well, that's when litigation comes into play, and we argue those issues and say the states are overreaching. Since it is a joint federal and state program, the rules are going to vary by states. Medicaid planning in Wisconsin is going to be slightly different than the Medicaid planning in Michigan, which is slightly different than Medicaid planning in Florida, in Texas, so on and so forth. So again, they're all going to be relatively the same, but each state will have its own slight nuance as to how they interpret those federal laws. And in order to qualify for Medicaid, applicants must meet specific financial and non-financial criteria in order to qualify. The Medicaid program that we're going to be talking about today is going to be Medicaid within a nursing home setting. So Medicaid is going to pay for a person's custodial care. And why is this important? Well, it's the sheer cost of staying in a nursing home. It's wild to think that in a semi-private room, the average cost nationwide is $9,277 per month. If you want to get in a private room, you're looking at over $10,000 a month. Now, since we're talking about Medicaid, we're typically going to be referring to a semi-private room. And again, at almost $9,300 per month, if you annualize that, that's about $112,000 per year. Put that into perspective, if you look at Harvard University, including room and board, it's estimated that going to Harvard as an undergraduate costs about $83,000 per year. So staying in a nursing home is almost $40,000 more per year than attending Harvard, including your room and board at Harvard. So cost is just outrageous. The individuals that we're working with that are typically going to be applying for nursing home Medicaid are going to be seniors. They're towards the end of their life, and most individuals just don't have that much money saved up where they can afford Medicaid. So that's why Medicaid is so important. And Medicaid is going to pick up the difference. So an individual that qualifies for Medicaid, basically all of their income will go towards their monthly share of costs, and then Medicaid is going to pick up the difference. So there's a huge financial relief for someone who can qualify for Medicaid, as if their income is going to go for their care. And we'll discuss that later on in the upcoming slides. So starting with the non-financial criteria, this is usually the easier requirements to meet. Again, we're talking about individuals in a nursing home, so they're going to be elderly, and it's going to be, usually typically easy to meet. So they have to be a U.S. citizen or qualified non-citizen, be age 65 or older, blind or disabled, by being in the nursing home, assuming they're not just there by choice because they want to be there. They're obviously probably going to have some kind of medical reason to be there. So the second one's pretty easy to meet. And then they have to reside in a Medicaid-approved facility. So there are nursing homes out there that are just simply private pay. The nursing home facility your client is at does not accept Medicaid. Can't qualify for Medicaid if they're not in a Medicaid-approved facility. So they would have to move into a facility that accepts Medicaid. So when you're talking to your clients and you're discussing what nursing home they're in, just ask, is it a Medicaid-approved facility? If it is, then we can do this type of planning. If it's not, it's simply a private pay facility, know that they're going to have to relocate before we can do any form of Medicaid planning. As a facility, we'll have to accept Medicaid as a form of payment. But typically, it's not that big of an issue. So now let's get into the financial requirements. So when we're talking about Medicaid planning, there are potentially two individuals we're going to be concerned with. The first one is the institutionalized individual. This is going to be the person that is in the nursing home that we're going to be applying for Medicaid benefits on behalf of. This person may be single or married, and if they are married, if they have a spouse living in the house, that individual is going to be known as the community spouse, and the community spouse is going to have a separate set of income and asset requirements. So again, we have the institutionalized person, the person in the nursing home, we're going to be applying for Medicaid on behalf of, and if they're married and they have a spouse in the house, then we have a community spouse is going to have their own separate rules and requirements. So starting with the institutionalized individual, in most states, the institutionalized person's income must be less than the private pay rate at the facility. Now, this is typically not an issue. As we just saw, the average cost is about $9,300 a month. Most individuals, when they're elderly in the nursing home, their income sources are typically Social Security and pension. If they have an IRA, requirement of distributions, again, they're typically not, most individuals are not going to have about $10,000 a month of income. Again, the income test is usually not that hard of a requirement to meet. And when we are talking about income, we're talking about gross income as well. So basically their total gross income must be less than the monthly private pay rate at the facility they're at. And as I mentioned earlier, basically all of the institutionalized person's income is going to go to the nursing home as their monthly share of costs or their Medicaid copay amount. There are some deductions that we can take out of the institutionalized person's income each and every month. The first one is going to be what's referred to as a personal needs allowance, right? I like to refer to it as, call it as the haircuts and Snickers bars account. In most states, the institutionalized person is only allowed to keep about $50 each month to spend on personal items. That can be haircuts, snacks, things like that. It's not much money each month, but it's a small amount that they're allowed to spend on personal items each and every month. They can also pay for medical expenses. So think Medicare insurance, Medicare supplements, things like that. They can pay for those types of deductions. And if they're married and their spouse has low income, we may be able to shift some of their income dollar for dollar over to their community spouse, bring the community spouse up to a minimum level income, which we'll touch on later. But basically, all their income will go to the nursing home as part of their monthly share of costs. Now, depending on what state you're in, some states will require an additional step known as a qualified income trust. So if the institutionalized person's gross income exceeds $2,901 in most states, then they will have to set up a qualified income trust for the amount of money that they're over income. So if they have $3,000 of gross monthly income and they're in a qualified income trust state, then at least $99 each month would first have to flow into the qualified income trust, and then it'll get paid to the nursing home. Someone who taught this course at another company would always refer to this as legal money laundering. Again, it's only in about half the states where this is required, and it's an irrevocable income-only trust. Its sole purpose is basically qualifying for Medicaid benefits. If you are in a state that requires a qualified income trust, a lot of states will have basically a generic form that you can complete to establish the trust at the bank. So just complete that, give it to the bank, and you can open up a qualified income trust bank account. Then we can send the funds directly into that, and then it'll just get paid to the nursing home. A qualified income trust is also known as a Miller trust. So if you ever heard that term thrown around, no, it's the same thing. And not every state requires a qualified income trust. Again, look at your state rules to see if you require one or not. But again, at the end of the day, all of your income minus the two deductions, regardless if you needed income, if you're an income cap state or not, all of it will go to the nursing home as the monthly share. Now let's switch over to the community spouse. This is going to be the spouse in the house. If you're doing this type of planning, I encourage you to highlight, star, circle, disperse, bullet point, as it's very important. There are no limits on the amount of income the community spouse may have. The community spouse can have essentially unlimited income, and it will not affect the Medicaid eligibility of the institutionalized individual. So if they have $100,000 a month of income, that is completely fine. It's not going to affect their institutionalized spouse's Medicaid eligibility. However, if the community spouse has low income, the government has established anti-impoverishment rules. So if the community spouse's income falls below a certain amount known as the monthly maintenance needs allowance or the MINMA, we can shift income from the institutionalized spouse over to the community spouse dollar for dollar until the community spouse has a minimum amount of income that they are entitled to each and every month. So again, the monthly maintenance needs allowance is the amount of income the community spouse is entitled to if they have low income. Depending on what state you're in, some states will just list one number for the min. If you are in a one-number state, the standard minima state, that number is typically $3,948. So if your community spouse has income less than that amount, we'll be able to take income from the institutionalized person, give it to the community spouse each and every month, dollar for dollar, until the community spouse has $3,948 of monthly income. Now, there are some states where they'll list two monthly maintenance needs allowance figures. One will be, they'll say, a minimum and a maximum minima. Know that the community spouse is always entitled to the minimum monthly maintenance needs allowance, and that number is typically most states, $2,555. However, if we can show what's referred to as excess shelter expenses, we could increase that minimal amount up to the maximum dollar for dollar for those excess shelter expenses. Now, when we're talking about excess shelter expenses, we're talking about things like rent, mortgage, property tax on a monthly basis, HOA fees, renter's insurance, homeowner's insurance. Some of these expenses are usually not paid for monthly, so it's like an annual, like a property tax. Just take that property tax bill, divide it by 12 or however it's paid to put it on a monthly basis and add all those up. And if they exceed a certain amount, then we could increase their monthly maintenance needs allowance from the minimal up to the maximum amount. I'm not going to get into much more detail other than that. However, if you are interested in how this is calculated on a more in-depth explanation, we do have a short 4 or 5 minute video on our website, crossfinancial.com, that goes over how you can calculate the minima if you're in one of these minimum maximum states. For time purposes, I'm just going to ask that. But just know, the community spouse is always allowed, is always entitled to a minimum level of income. However, they can have unlimited income. So if the community spouse's income exceeds their monthly maintenance needs allowance, that's fine. It's completely acceptable. They will just not receive a shifting of income from the institutionalized person. And remember, all the institutionalized person's income minus a few deductions will go to the nursing home as part of their monthly share of costs. So those are the income requirements. Now let's switch sides and look at assets. So again, we have our two parties here, potentially two parties. We have the institutionalized individual, the one that's in the nursing home. And if they're married, their spouse in the house or the community spouse. And again, they're each going to have their own separate set of asset requirements. So in most states, the institutionalized individual is only allowed to keep $2,000 in countable assets. We have been seeing a trend for 2025 that some states are actually increasing this. So keep on a lookout for your state, particularly 2026 when these numbers are updated. And if you are a $2,000 state, hopefully, your state will increase that figure as these numbers do tend to change every year. But most states, it's still around $2,000. But again, we have seen, states starting to increase the individual resource allowance across the country. The community spouse is allowed a separate amount of assets that they can retain, which is known as the community spouse resource allowance. And when we're talking about community spouse and assets, we're referring to the assets as the couple as a whole. Medicaid is not concerned with which individual owns the particular asset. It's either going to be countable or exempt. So if it's the countable assets, we're going to pool the assets of the couple as a whole together, and that will determine our community spouse resource allowance. So again, depending on what type of state you're in, if you're in a standard community spouse resource allowance state, this is where it'll just list one number for the community spouse. That's the amount of assets they're allowed to have. In these standardized states, that amount is typically $157,920. Now, there are some other states that will list two numbers, a minimum and a maximum figure. So in these states, what we have to do is combine the couple's total countable assets as of a date known as the snapshot. The snapshot date is the first day of a 30-day continuous period of institutionalization. So let's say we have a client who had a stroke. They entered the hospital on day one. They stayed in the hospital, were transitioned directly from the hospital into the nursing home. They never went home. They went straight from the hospital to the nursing home, and they were there for 30 consecutive days. We'd be looking at the assets as of the couple's total assets as of the first day they entered the hospital. That is going to be referred to as a snapshot. So we're going to take the couple's total combined assets, and the community spouse in these minimal maximum states is allowed to keep one half of the couple's total combined assets as of the snapshot date, given the minimum and the maximum figures. So for example, if the couple had $500,000 as of that snapshot date, one half of that would be $250,000. Since $250,000 exceeds the maximum community spouse resource allowance, of $157,920, the community spouse would be entitled to the maximum $157,920. If the couple had $200,000 as of that snapshot date, one half of that would be $100,000. Since $100,000 fall between the minimum and the maximum, the community spouse would be entitled to $100,000. And on the opposite end of that is true as well. If they had $40,000 as of the snapshot date, one half of that is $20,000. Since that falls below the minimum community spouse resource allowance, the community spouse would be entitled to the minimum figure, which is typically $31,584. So if you're in one of these minimal maximum states, you have to compute the couple's total countable assets as of the snapshot date, and the community spouse is entitled to one half of their total combined assets, given the minimum and the maximum figures. If you're in a state that just lists the one number for the community spouse resource allowance, that's the number the community spouse is allowed to have. If they have less than that, they would automatically qualify. If they have more than that, then they would have to spend those assets down. And that's where our strategies come into play, is when individuals have assets in excess of the Medicaid. So now we know what the limits are, what is an exempt asset, and what's a countable asset. Well, starting with the exempt assets, these are things we do not have to concern ourselves with. It's simply going to be the primary residence, one vehicle, personal property, so common goods you find within the home. So that could be jewelry, artwork, electronics, watches, things like that. If the couple has any collectible items, those may be a little gray area there. But typically the common household items you find in your normal home are going to be exempt. If they have a Van Gogh painting or something like that, that's going to be a gray area. That might be considered countable. But again, you're just your normal everyday personal property effects are going to be exempt. They're allowed a small whole life insurance policy, depending what state you're in, anywhere from like $1,500 to $10,000. And you can have an irrevocable funeral expense trust, so prepaying those funeral expenses. And in most states, they're allowed up to $15,000 for each individual for those irrevocable funeral expense trusts. Those are going to be your exempt assets you do not have to concern yourself with as it relates to Medicaid qualification. Now, the countable assets are going to be basically everything else. So it's anything that's easily converted into cash, basically. So we're talking about checking savings accounts, CDs, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, brokerage accounts, tax-deferred annuities, life insurance with high cash value. If it exceeds those whole life insurance policy limits, which most of them will, that's going to be countable. Additional real estate and vehicles are typically countable in states as well. And IRAs are going to be are going to vary state by state. So a general rule of thumb that we always say is, generally speaking, IRAs are going to be countable unless your state explicitly excludes them. So in a lot of states, IRAs will be countable for both individuals. In some states, IRAs may be exempt for one spouse and countable for the other spouse. And in some states, IRAs may be countable for both spouses or exempt for both spouses. So again, look at your state regs, see how IRAs are treated. We say as a general rule of thumb, IRAs are countable unless your state explicitly exempts them. So if we have assets in excess of the Medicaid limits, what can we do? How can we spend these assets down in order to qualify? And again, typically clients will have an asset problem, not an income problem. So ideally, we want to spend these assets down intelligently. We don't just simply want to pay the nursing home each and every month until they meet the Medicaid limits. We can spend it more intelligently than that. So we can purchase things for fair market value. So we pay off their mortgage, their credit card debt, other bills. They could purchase or improve an exempt asset. So if they own a home, we can improve the kitchen, put a new roof on the home. We can make it more handicap or elderly friendly. The client's driving a 1996 Buick. We can upgrade that car to a new Mercedes-Benz if they like. Things like that. They can upgrade the furnishings in the home. They can purchase those irrevocable funeral expense trusts. In most states, again, they can purchase up for up to $15,000 for each spouse. It's a great way to spend down some excess funds that, you know, death and taxes are what's guaranteed in the world, right? So by purchasing funeral expenses, we're just prepaying those final expenses and taking that burden off of loved ones after you pass away. And finally, my personal, very unbiased opinion, my favorite one is purchasing a Medicaid-compliant annuity. By buying a Medicaid annuity, quick and easy spend down, get a child real quick, and we can protect assets, utilize strategies to help protect assets as well while accelerating the Medicaid eligibility. So now let's talk about the Medicaid-compliant annuity. Again, my personal favorite spend down tool. The Medicaid-compliant annuity is a very special type of annuity that's designed for Medicaid qualification. So it's technically a single premium immediate annuity that meets the requirements of the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005. So basically what I just said is we take a lump sum of cash, put it into this special type of annuity, and it converts what Medicaid would normally view as an asset into simply a stream of income. These types of annuities will have zero cash value. You cannot cash them out. And it's just simply a stream of income. So as long as this annuity meets the Medicaid requirements, again, we're able to take a lump sum of cash and convert it simply into a stream of income. Depending on the case facts, client situation, depends how we utilize the annuity and the planning strategies surrounding it. So our Medicaid compliant annuity, although it's the same thing, will be utilized differently for a single person case than it would be for a married couple case. We'll discuss how it's utilized when we talk about it, when we get into our case studies a little later on. But first off, what are the requirements of a Medicaid annuity? Well, for an annuity to be considered Medicaid compliant, there are five requirements that the annuity must meet. The annuity must meet all five of these requirements. It does not meet one of these requirements, the annuity will not be considered Medicaid compliant, and it will either be treated as a countable asset or a transfer for less than fair market value subject to penalty. So a Medicaid annuity needs to be irrevocable, non-assignable, actuarially sound, make equal payments, and the state has to be named as a beneficiary in the appropriate position. So starting with being irrevocable, the annuity needs to be irrevocable in every sense of the term. So once the annuity is purchased, everything is set in stone. You may not make any changes to it whatsoever. You cannot change the owner, the annuitant, the payee, the beneficiaries. You cannot change the term of the annuity. We cannot add money to it. We cannot take money out of it. We cannot change the payment amount. Nothing on this contract may be altered after it is purchased. It is completely set in stone, completely irrevocable to every sense of the term. The second requirement is non-assignable. There are some companies out there, if you watch, spend any time watching daytime television, they have some pretty catchy jingles, but there are some companies out there that will purchase annuities, lottery winnings, structured settlements, things like that. They'll purchase them on the secondary market. So they'll give you a lump sum of cash for a future payment stream. There is specific language in these contracts that explicitly prohibit this type of transaction. So you cannot sell the future payment stream on the secondary market. You cannot assign those payments to a third party. You cannot put the annuity up for collateral for a loan at a bank. We cannot assign the future payments to a third party. So it is completely non-assignable, and these contracts had zero secondary market value. So in some states, they want us to test this. So they will have us go to the secondary market, submit the contract for offers to purchase, and those companies will come back and say, nope, cannot purchase it. There is explicit language that says it's non-assignable. It cannot be sold. So we are not willing to purchase this contract from you. So there's zero value on the secondary market. The third test is the actuarially sound test. What this test says is the term of the annuity cannot exceed the owner's Medicaid life expectancy. However, it may be shorter than, so it needs to be equal to or less than the owner's Medicaid life expectancy. So what is an individual's Medicaid life expectancy? So it is an age and gender-based table. And depending on your state, you either utilize the Social Security Administration Medicaid life expectancy table, or your state may have their own Medicaid life expectancy table. But either way, the tables work the exact same ones. It'll be an age and gender-based table. So let's say we have an 85-year-old male. We're just going to go to 85 and male. And in the Social Security table, we'll see an 85-year-old male has a Medicaid life expectancy of 5.65 years. Since Medicaid annuities are typically purchased in a number of months, we're just going to multiply 5.65 years by 12 to get their Medicaid life expectancy on a monthly basis. So in this case, their Medicaid life expectancy would be 67.80 months for an 85-year-old male. So what this tells us is the maximum term annuity we could purchase is going to be 67 months. This annuity was purchased for 68 months. It would fail the actuary sound test as the term of the annuity would exceed the owner's Medicaid life expectancy. So again, that establishes the maximum term in this example, 67 months. However, it's not established a minimum term in most states. So we could purchase it for 60 months, 48 months, 36 months. The shortest term annuity is 2 months. So long as the term of the annuity does not exceed the owner's Medicaid life expectancy, we will meet this test and we're going to pass this criteria. So the next criteria is this annuity needs to make equal payments. So the first payment is going to be the exact same as the last payment. Unfortunately, we cannot have a cost of living rider, an inflation adjusted rider, anything like that. The first payment is going to be the exact same as the last payment. We cannot defer payments. We cannot have a large balloon payment at the end. That was popular way back in the 90s, where they buy annuities that would just pay basically the interest amount. Then the final payment would be a large balloon annuity. Those are no longer allowed. They need to be equal payments. So the first payment is going to be the exact same as the last payment. These types of annuities are going to make a fixed number of payments. So, for example, if we have a 48-month annuity, the annuity will make 48 equal month payments. After the 48th payment, the annuity is going to be effectively closed out. There's nothing left. In the annuity will not make a 49th payment. Now, if the client previously uses this 48-month annuity, let's say they pass away after 36 months, there's still 12 payments remaining in that annuity. So those remaining 12 payments will then get paid out to whomever is named as the death beneficiary, which brings us to our fifth and final point, that the state has to be named as a beneficiary in the appropriate position. So generally speaking, the state Medicaid agency is going to be named as primary death beneficiary for the amount of Medicaid benefits provided on behalf of the institutionalized individual. However, there are some exceptions to this rule. So if the institutionalized person is married and they have a community spouse at home, the institutionalized person is purchasing the annuity, they can always name the community spouse before the state. Also, if there is a minor and or disabled child, they can always name that individual before the state as well. However, in most situations, the state will be named as primary death beneficiary for the amount of Medicaid benefits provided on behalf of the institutionalized individual. If the state does have a repayment, I will discuss with these case studies how we can try to avoid that. But if the state does have a repayment, there is still some benefit there, as the state will get repaid at what they paid out, which is the Medicaid reimbursement rate, as opposed to if you just privately pay in the private pay rate. The Medicaid reimbursement rate is typically a couple thousand dollars less per month than the private pay rate. The Medicaid rate is a rate that Medicaid negotiates with that nursing home. So again, it's a rate that Medicaid pays. Us are the private individuals. We have to pay the private pay rate. Once we qualify for Medicaid, Medicaid pays a different rate. So even if the state does get paid back, there are still some savings. Another thing we can purchase Medicaid compliant annuities with non-qualified dollars and tax qualified dollars. So non-qualified dollars are your typical everyday funds, post-tax accounts. So things your normal checking and savings accounts, your old brokerage account, things like that. If your client has an IRA, a 401k, a 403b, other pre-tax retirement accounts, know that we can purchase an IRA Medicaid compliant annuity. So as opposed to liquidating those accounts, paying all the taxes at in one tax year, we can move those funds via either trustee to trustee transfer or 60-day rollover that meet the IRS requirements into an IRA Medicaid compliant annuity. So what this does is we're able to preserve the pre-tax status of those funds. And then as the Medicaid annuity makes payments, those payments will be fully taxable in the tax year that payment is received. So what we're able to do by purchasing an IRA Medicaid annuity is spread that tax liability out over the duration of the Medicaid annuity, again, as opposed to just liquidating those accounts and paying all the taxes in the same tax year. So we're able to spread out that tax liability by buying an IRA Medicaid compliant annuity. So when is a Medicaid compliant annuity appropriate? So the institutionalized person is going to reside in a Medicaid approved facility and they're expected to remain there indefinitely. If they have Medicare benefits, they exhausted those benefits. They have long-term care insurance that either exhausted all their long-term care insurance benefits or their benefit is not sufficient enough to fully private pay for their care. So they're paying for their care out of pocket and they're, and they have assets in excess of the Medicaid limits. So they're in a Medicaid-approved facility at a nursing home. They're privately paying, and they have assets in excess of the Medicaid limits. So as long as they meet these criteria, a Medicaid-compliant annuity may be appropriate for your client. So now we know the income rules, the asset rules, what a Medicaid annuity is. Now let's go over some of the planning strategies. So I will first start off with our first case study, which is the married couple case study. So a typical planning strategy we see for a married couple is we're going to be at each spouse the amount of assets they're allowed to keep and then have the community spouse purchase the Medicaid annuity for the excess countable assets. So the institutionalized person to be allowed to keep $2,000. The community spouse allowed to keep their community spouse resource allowance, usually an amount up to about $157,000 and change. Anything in addition to will have the community spouse purchase a Medicaid annuity. By doing this, we're eliminating the excess countable assets by purchase of the Medicaid annuity. And we're, since the community spouse is purchasing the annuity, we're going to be creating an income stream for the community spouse. As long as the community spouse outlives the term of the annuity, by utilizing the strategy, we're able to protect 100% of the assets on behalf of the community spouse, all the while being able to immediately qualify their institutionalized spouse for Medicaid benefits, assuming they have not made any previous gifts within the past 60 months. Let's get into this case study now. So we have Walt and Maggie. Walt is an 84-year-old male. Maggie is 82. They're a married couple. Walt has dementia. Maggie was taking care of Walt in the home. Unfortunately, Walt's condition declined. Maggie could no longer care for Walt, and she reluctantly had to transfer him into a nursing home. All was fine and well in the world. Walt was getting the care that she needed. Maggie had a huge weight lifted off her shoulders that she no longer had that responsibility of taking care of Walt. However, Maggie got that first nursing home bill in the mail at about $9,500 per month. Her jaw hit the floor. She's like, I can't afford this. She's worried Walt's going to get kicked out on the street. She's going to go broke. She's not going to be able to live her life. And it's just a miserable situation. So they saw your ad on Facebook. Maggie decided to come into your office to see what could be done as she realized they could not afford this care for very long. Let's take a look at the case facts. So we have Walt. He has income for Social Security pension of $2,800. Maggie's income against Social Security pension, $2,300. Walt's cost of care is $9,500. And they have total countable assets of $375,000. So if they did absolutely nothing and just continued to privately pay for Wolt's care, they'll deplete their accountable assets in as little as 39 months. What's even worse about this is Maggie is in it. She's healthy. She is, you know, playing bingo every Wednesday night with her buddies. So she needs money to live off of. So the more money they spend on Wolt's care means the less money we have left for Maggie to live off of. So we definitely want to do something here in order to protect some assets on behalf of Maggie. And that's why Maggie came into your office to protect those assets and see what could be. The first step is we're going to calculate their spend down amount. So Maggie, as the community spouse, can keep the home, the car, furniture, personal property, and community spouse resource allowance, in this case, is the full maximum, $157,920. So they have $375,000 of countable assets. If we're in a minimal maximum state, if we divide that by two, that leaves $187,500. Since $187,000 exceeds the maximum community spouse resource allowance of $157,920, Maggie is allowed the maximum community spouse resource allowance of $157,920. However, to avoid being right on the edge of Medicaid eligibility, we're going to leave Maggie slightly less. We're going to leave her with $155,000. This could maybe Maggie has some a brokerage account that fluctuates in value or something. We just want to build in a small buffer zone there because if she's $1 over, she's not going to qualify. We're going to have to do another spend down. So we want to build in a small buffer to make sure they qualify right away. And while as the institutionalized individual, in this case, about $2,000, they have a spend down amount of $218,000 for this case. So again, we're going to purchase a Medicaid client annuity on behalf of Maggie. So we're going to pull out our life expectancy table, and Maggie, an 82-year-old female, we go to our chart, and our chart says her Medicaid life expectancy is 8.26 years. So again, we're just simply going to multiply 8.26 by 12, and we get 99.12 months. This means the maximum term annuity we can purchase is 99 months. So we have the discussion. We can always go shorter. We discuss that with Maggie. You might want to go shorter is if you're worried about a state recovery because the state's going to have to be named as primary death beneficiary. Maybe Maggie just wants the funds back relatively quickly. You might want to go longer if Maggie just feels comfortable with a long payment stream. She wants that payment coming in for as long as possible. Maybe she's not comfortable handling the finances. Maybe Maggie has low income and you want to try to maximize that monthly maintenance needs allowance shift. You want to stretch the annuity out for as long as possible, keep that annuity payment as small as possible. So we had a discussion with Maggie, and from what we see across financial, from a national average term for community spouse annuities, we usually see about 24 to 36 months as a national average. As a lot of attorneys feel that's a good term, as the community spouse gets the funds back relatively quickly. However, it's not a super short term that may raise potential eyebrows with the caseworkers who may make their, that caseworker might then get offended and make their application more difficult than it needs to. So, again, on average, we see 24 to 36 months across financial for community spouse annuity. After having a discussion with Maggie at the end of the day, whatever you and your client are comfortable with, as long as it meets Medicaid criteria, we're comfortable with it as well. So in this case, you decided on a 36 month Medicaid compliant. So Maggie, as the community spouse, is the owner, annuitant, payee. For the scenario, we took the full spend down amount, $218,000, eliminated that as an asset, and converted it into a stream of income by purchasing this Medicaid compliant annuity. And it's going to pay Maggie $6,100 over the next 36 months. So now we purchased the annuity, we're going to apply for Medicaid. So what do we do to Maggie's income? So again, we eliminated all those excess assets by purchase of the annuity. Maggie's income went from $2,300. We added the Medicaid compliant annuity income for the next 36 months of $6,100. So Maggie's new income is now $8,400. Wealth is immediately eligible for Medicaid benefits because they made no previous gifts in the past 60 months. So Walt's immediately eligible, and his income, $2,800, minus his personal needs allowance of $50, which means his Medicaid copay amount is $2,750. Now, if this was a real world case, he'd probably have a Medicare premium or something in there like that. That would reduce it a little bit, but just keep numbers simple. We did not include any of. So what are we just doing here? Well, we were able to achieve immediate Medicaid eligibility for Walt, and we took what they're originally privately paying, $9,500, reduced that down to only $2,750. So this couple is saving $6,750 per month. If we annualize that, they're saving around $81,000 per year by qualifying for Medicaid. Additionally, Maggie's income was increased up to $8,400, so now she has sufficient income to meet her needs within the community, and we were able to increase it above the MNMA rules had we wanted to do something like that. So she has sufficient income to live off of. And what's really nice about this planning, and this is another key bullet point, so if you're new, star, highlight, circle this last bullet point. If Maggie doesn't spend that down each and every month, that's fine. As long as it's after the initial qualification of Walt, Maggie can have Medicaid is no longer concerned with the assets of Maggie. Again, as long as it's after the initial qualification, Maggie can win the lottery and it will not affect Walt's Medicaid eligibility. So she can accumulate those funds. It will not affect his eligibility. So to recap, some additional considerations. Maggie needs to enter the nursing home before a 3-year period is up. Unfortunately, we can't do anything to the annuity, so that's just her income. So it'll be her income, part of her monthly copay amount, or maybe her income's too high and she would qualify. Again, we can't do anything about it. But if you feel that is that maybe a possibility, we could always use a shorter term annuity when we purchased it. Maybe you wanted to use a 24-month annuity or a 12-month annuity, which we could have done when we purchased it. And Lori should maybe predeceased determine the annuity, with the state being his primary death beneficiary. The state would have a right to recover the remaining amount in the annuity. Again, they repeat at the Medicaid reimbursement rate. Anything left over will get paid out to whoever they need after the state. In this case, that was their children. So again, to recap, immediate Medicaid eligibility. As long as Maggie outlives the term of the annuity, we're able to protect 100% of the assets on behalf of Maggie. Let's get into the single person case study. The typical planning strategy for a single person was referred to as the gift and annuity option. This is where we're going to make an intentional gift of approximately one half of the assets. This could be gifted to a loved one. It could be gifted to an irrevocable Medicaid asset protection trust. Could be gifted to a charity. Whatever the client's wishes are, we're going to make an intentional completed gift, get rid of about half the assets, or use the other approximate half to purchase a Medicaid annuity. Anytime we make a gift, then pass 60 months and apply for Medicaid, there are penalty period associated with that. So we're going to structure the term of the annuity over the same time frame as the penalty that was created. So during the penalty period, they'll have their income plus annuity income to privately pay for their care. All right, so let's meet Janice. Janice is a single person with dementia. Her family was staying care of her in the home. Fortunately, again, similar to Walt, her condition declined. Family could no longer care for her. So they transitioned her into a nursing home, realized they could not pay for her care for very long. So they came to your office for some help to see what could be. So again, let's take a look at the case facts. Janice has income from Social Security of $2,450, has total countable assets of $150,000. Her cost of care is $9,200. And in this particular state, the divestment penalty advisor is $8,250. So the divestment penalty advisor is a state published number. And what it's supposed to represent is the average monthly cost of a nursing home in that particular state. And this number is used to determine how long the penalty period will be. What this number represents is for every $8,250 that is gifted, that will equate to a 1-month penalty where the individual will have to privately pay for 1 month before Medicaid will start paying. So again, this number is used to determine how long the penalty period will be, and it represents how much the individual can gift that will equal a 1 month penalty. So if Janice does absolutely nothing and just continues to privately pay for a care at $9,200 a month, she'll deplete her condo assets in as little as 16 months. She has secured, she'll have nothing left to pass along to her loved ones. That's something really Janice always wanted to do, was to leave a legacy for her kids and her grandchildren. She wanted to leave them something after she passed to support them. So that was very important to her. She really wanted to leave a legacy to her loved ones. So now, similar to the married couple case, we're going to determine our spend down amount. Janice, being a single individual, is only allowed to keep $2,000 in her name. So we started with $150,000 of accountable assets. Janice is going to keep $2,000 of that. So that means the remaining amount, $148,000, is the amount we have to play with. That is our spend down amount. So our spend down is $148,000. The next step on this plan is we're going to calculate a figure that's called the burn rate. So this is where I like to take a 10,000 foot view of the plan. So the ultimate goal of this plan is to figure out how long Janice's money will last by means making 1 month's worth of gift and paying 1 month's worth of nursing home care. So remember, we want to maximize the amount we can gift while making sure we leave Janice enough money so she can privately pay for her care during that month, because we're gifting assets. So we want to figure out how that balances out. So to do this, we're going to take Janice's cost of care of $9,200. We're going to subtract out her income, Social Security pension, of $2,450. So this means Janice is short $6,750. So we know we're going to need to structure the annuity so it pays her approximately $6,750. So she needs an extra $6,750 each month so she can privately pay for her care. Now remember, we want to also gift money. So in this particular state, the investment penalty advisor is $8,250. Remember, that means for every $8,250 that's gifted, that's going to create a 1 month penalty. So since we want to maximize the gift amount and max relative pay for care, we're going to take our income shortfall, $6,750, add the investment penalty advisor of $8,250 to get $15,000. This is the burn rate. This means each and every month this plan is in place, we're going to burn through $15,000 by means of making 1 month's worth of gift and creating an additional income stream so she can privately pay for her care. So we're burning through $15,000 each month this plan is in place. So now we know what the burn rate is. We just simply take our spend down amount, $148,000, divide it by the burn rate to figure out how long our money is going to last. And we get a length of plan of 9.87 months. So to make everyone's lives easier, we're just simply going to round that figure up to 10 months. And we also want to do this to avoid being right on the edge of Medicaid eligibility, because that Medicaid annuity is going to pay a small amount of interest. So by rounding it up, we'll be reducing the amount that goes into the annuity to make sure that her total income is going to be slightly less than her cost of care to make sure that she's otherwise eligible so that penalty period starts. So now we know the length of the plan. Let's figure out what our gift amount is going to be. So our length of our plan is 10 months. That means we're going to make 10 months worth of gifts. We're going to gift that immediately right away. So we just simply multiply by 10 by our divestment penalty advisor, $8,250, which means we're making an immediate gift today of $82,500. So I'm writing that check out to Johnny for $82,500. That's an immediate gift to the loved ones. That's going to create a 10-month penalty period. So now we had $148,000 to start with. I just wrote that gift check to Johnny for $82,500. This leaves Janice with $65,500 left to fund her Medicaid compliant annuity. So we're taking that $65,500, putting it into a 10-month Medicaid compliant annuity. We made 10 months worth of gifts. We're going to have a 10-month penalty period, so we want to purchase a 10-month annuity. This annuity is Janice being single. She's going to be the owner and do it to the payee. So Sinoni is going to pay Janice $6,560 per month for the next 10 months. Janice is single. She does not have any minor or disabled children. So the state Medicaid agency is going to be named as primary death beneficiary with her children named as contingent. So now this is a very important step. So we made the gift, we purchased the annuity, and now we need to apply for Medicaid benefits. Because in order for our penalty period to start, Janice has to be considered otherwise eligible, meaning she meets all the Medicaid eligibility criteria and would normally be eligible for Medicaid. However, since she gifted assets, she has a penalty period where she has to privately pay for a specific period of time. Since we did the math, we know her penalty period is going to be 10 months. That's exactly what we planned for. So we're going to apply for Medicaid and say, great, Janice, you meet all these Medicaid criteria. However, since you gifted $82,500, you're going to have to privately pay for 10 months. And after the 10-month time period is up, penalty will be over and Medicaid will start paying for your benefits. So what do we do to her income? Because remember, she has an annuity now. So her original income is $2,450. She has this new Medicaid-compliant annuity income of $6,560. So her new income for the next 10 months during this penalty period is $9,010. Now, you may be saying to yourself, wait a second, Aaron, their cost of care was $9,200. We're still short. And yes, you are correct. That is done on purpose, because in order to be considered otherwise eligible, her total income needs to be less than her cost of care, so she can pay that $190 shortfall from the $2,000 that we left her. Otherwise, just have a conversation with the giftees and say, hey, Janice just gifted you all this money. She's going to be short each month to pay for her care. Out of the kindness of your heart, would you mind paying that small amount each month? As it's just what we have to do. It's what the law requires us. Remember, if you are in an income cap state, since Janice's income is $9,010, that's going to exceed the income cap of $2,901. So you'll have to set up that qualified income trust for that additional income. I would just put the entire annuity income in that qualified income trust, and I'll get paid to the nursing home. But just remember, if you are in one of those states, you have to set up that qualified income trust for this additional income. If you're not in a qualified income cap state, don't worry about it. You don't have to do that. So now I'm just putting things on a timeline. We're going to make the gift, purchase the annuity, apply for Medicaid all in the same month. Medicaid is going to come back and say, great, you're otherwise eligible. The penalty period is going to start. We're going to privately pay 10 months for this penalty period. And after the 10-month penalty period ends, the annuity stops making payments, and Janice starts receiving Medicaid benefits at that point in time. So what do we just do here? So after the 10-month plan, Janice's monthly income reverts back to $2,450 after accounting for a $50 personal needs allowance. Her nurse, her Medicaid copay amount equals $2,400. So we're saving her $6,800 per month compared to when she was privately paying at $9,200 per month. Again, if we annualize that monthly savings, that's $81,600 per year we're saving Janice and her family. All the while, Janice was able to make a guaranteed wealth transfer. So remember, she wrote that check at the beginning of planning. She got that money out of her name. So she wrote that check for $82,500 she gifted to her children immediately, which is over 55% of their original spend on it. What a great plan. So additional considerations, if Janice were to predecease the 10-month plan, since unless she was previously on Medicaid, since she's probably paying the entire time, Medicaid would not have a claim because it didn't pay anything out on her behalf. So any remaining benefit would then get paid out to her continued beneficiaries, in which case were her kids. And if Janice's care were to increase or she has some unexpected medical expenses, unfortunately, again, this is where you're going to want to have a conversation with the giftees and just let them know, hey, if something like this were to happen, you just got all this gifted money. You may want to put it in a separate account and just set it aside in case something like this happens out of the kindness of your heart. You know, would you pay for your mother's additional expenses? So again, great plan. It will save over 55% of the fundable resources for Janus, and we've accelerated your Medicaid eligibility for just up to 10 months of private. If you would like to learn more, I bet you this kind of throughout the presentation, we do have a beautiful website with a ton of educational materials. So go to crossfinancial.com and register for, we have a free attorney access account, which will have a wealth of information and educational information on there. If you'd like to upgrade your premium, know that there's tons of COEs on there that you can get credit for. We have expanded more Medicaid planning, state-specific planning figures under the paid side. We have Medicaid planning calculators, Medicaid annuity quote things, things like that. They're only available for premium members. And I'm out over time, so so I do apologize for running a little, don't have any time for questions. Unfortunately, I want to respect all of your time. So thank you for attending. Really appreciate it. Hope you learned something and enjoy it.
If you do have any questions, just reach out to us and we will get those answered right away. Thank you again, Aaron, for your great presentation. And thank you to everyone for joining us today for completing that post-webinar survey. Have a great afternoon.
Thanks, everyone. Appreciate it. Thanks for attending.